It's Tuesday, October 6th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello. Coming up, questions about Russian airstrikes in Syria. A massive free trade deal is reached.
They wish they could go to this school when they was my age, because when they was my age, it required a lot of money and working to get to school.
Cambodia experiments with a bold education plan. Also ahead, survival on Mars. In the movies, that is. It's all on today's International Edition. Western governments have criticized Russia's involvement in Syria, saying Russian airstrikes are targeting rebels instead of extremists. While NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg says they are not contributing to the security and stability of the region. The U.S. State Department on Monday called the intrusions reckless and provocative, and Russian military involvement a strategic mistake in general. Speaking Sunday on Iranian television, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad warned that Russia's military intervention in his country must succeed. The Syrian leader says if Iran, Syria, and Russia unite to fight terrorism, the chance of success is high. Russian airstrikes were launched last week and said to be aimed at Islamic State targets. But the United States indicates Moscow is trying to prop up the Assad regime. Regional analyst Joseph Olmert, a political science professor at the University of South Carolina, told VOA's Victor Beatty he believes Russian strategy is to broaden the territory controlled by Mr. Assad's forces prior to any political solution.
We have to understand the basic fact that there is no one Syria anymore. There is not going to be one Syria again. We talk here about a campaign by the allies of Bashar Assad to save him and what's left of his regime and Alawite community. Right now what happens is that they are trying to enlarge the enclave that is dominated by the Alawite community and the Syrian regime. If they will move on to other parts of Syria, that remains to be seen. But the aerial campaign will not put an end to ISIS, nor will it put an end to other rebel Islamic Sunni groups in Syria. That's the lesson of all kinds of conflicts that were before in the Middle East, including the Israeli attacks on Hezbollah in 2006 in retaliation to what they did to Israel and the Gaza campaign. So what Bashar Assad basically saying is, they're going to save me. Of course, he links it to the rest of the Middle East. That's an exaggeration, to say it very mildly.
Russia again targeted what they claim were Islamic State targets, but others question whether or not they're IS targets or they're part of the Free Syrian Army, which is, quote-unquote, a moderate alternative to the Assad regime. What do you think their endgame is, Russia is?
What they're doing is very simple. If they attack targets at Homs, they don't attack ISIS. ISIS is not based at Homs. At Homs, there are Sunni rebel groups, whether it is the Free Syrian Army or the Jaish of Islam, the Army of Islam, or any of those groups. The Russian game, as far as I can see, is to enlarge the enclave of the Alawites, to stretch it beyond what it is today, and to lift the basically siege that exists today on this enclave, because the rebels control the high roads from Homs to the north. So they basically cut off Damascus from, or at least they are endangering a cutoff of Damascus from the Alawite enclave along the, along the coast in the northwestern part of Syria. So that's what the Russians are doing now. And I emphasize the word now because it remains to be seen whether it will be the end game or they will use whatever success they have now, if they have any, in order to try and drive rebel groups out of other territories of Syria.
Apparently what Russia is doing in Syria is playing very well at home. The Associated Press says it proves to Russian people that Moscow is showing up the U.S. and reclaiming its rightful place as a global power.
But that's a great point that you make. Well, of course, Russian public opinion, I mean, you know, we don't need to be too much impressed with Russian-oriented reports about how other people like what's happening. If there will be coffins with bodies of Russian soldiers, not that I wish it to happen, return to Moscow, there will be a change there. But the point really is that throughout the Syrian crisis, the Russians definitely targeted Syria as an example of what would not be what they call Pax Americana. That's very true. whether Russia can really reclaim its previous status as a superpower comparable to the U.S., I doubt it very much. But they are identifying what they perceive to be a sign of weakness in American policy, and they entering what seems to be a vacuum created by the lack of decisive American policy.
Olmert says Russian strategy in Syria is potentially risky. He says Moscow has decided to side with the minority Shiite Muslims. And he says while it is too early to draw any firm conclusions if Moscow is perceived as going after the entire Sunni opposition to the Assad regime, that could have serious policy implications in its relations with countries like Saudi Arabia and Turkey. Well, it's time for us to check out what's trending online with our social media correspondent, G. Abby Lee. As always, she joins me right here in Studio 22 to discuss today's top story. Hi, G.
Hello, Jim.
The situation in Syria is not getting any better, is it?
You're right. And the signs are pretty clear on Twitter. Many news outlets and journalists are tweeting about the ISIL's attack on Palmyra and the Russian airstrikes in the country. Here are two tweets from CNN's chief international correspondent, Christian Amanpour. Russian MP implies Free Syrian Army is a legitimate target. Another one reads like this. Russia didn't join the American-led coalition against ISIS because it's been, quote, absolutely inefficient, unquote, says Russian MP. Those quotes are from her interview with a Russian member of the parliament, and she's on Twitter at C. Amanpour.
Well, I might add that Washington doesn't view the Free Syrian Army as a legitimate target. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about another media account that's worth following?
Sure. The London-based newspaper The Economist tweeted a link to one of its articles. The piece details the danger of Russia's intervention in Syria and America's involvement in Afghanistan. In the same tweet, it wrote, Putin dares, Obama dithers, Syria suffers. And that tweet seemed to resonate with many Twitter users who say it's an accurate description of what's happening in the region.
Unfortunately so. Mm-hmm. So did either President Obama or President Putin tweet about Syria?
Well, President Obama didn't, and neither did the official Kremlin news account at KremlinRussia_E. But the U.S. Embassy in Syria did tweet a quote from the president. The embassy is on Twitter at U.S. Embassy Syria, and the tweet reads like this. POTUS Colin, we reject Russia's theory that everybody opposed to Assad is a terrorist. Now that's, of course, referring to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, who views groups opposed to his government as terrorist groups. And Russia is on the same page as Assad, and the West isn't. Jim?
Well, thanks for that great analysis. G. Abby Lee in our studio. You can follow her on Twitter, at G. Abby Lee. This is VOA.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. The United States, Japan, and 10 other Pacific Rim countries reached agreement Monday on a massive free trade deal that will lower trading barriers and set commercial rules for 40% of the world's economy. For it to take effect, the pact must be ratified by national legislatures throughout the 12-country bloc, and completion of the deal is considered a major foreign policy victory for President Barack Obama. VOA economics writer Ken Bredemeyer joins me in the studio for an overview of the pact. The Trans-Pacific Partnership deal was completed in the southern U.S. city of Atlanta, Georgia, the culmination of 7 years of often contentious negotiations over trade barriers. Ken, this took a long time to complete.
Well, at this point, the negotiations had gone on so long, and they had gotten down into the nitty-gritty of disagreements between various countries. It wasn't that all of them couldn't agree. It was usually one or two that were at odds with each other. It may have been dairy products, automobile rules about what constitutes a manufacturer of a car inside of a country. So a lot of things had to come together to get to the point of finally reaching an agreement. This is a big victory for President Barack Obama, who had espoused this law, had authority to get to a deal, and that's what he wanted to get done.
And this is essentially a free trade deal within the Asia-Pacific region.
Right. There are 12 countries, Japan, the U.S., Canada, Chile, Peru, several Southeast Asian countries. A notable exception, China is not part of it. And most economic analysts view this deal as a means for the U.S. and Japan to counter the big economic influence of China. China's the second largest economy in the world. Maybe it will join this pact at some point, but certainly not for the foreseeable future.
Now, interesting, the political support here in the United States usually is divided among partisan lines, Republicans and Democrats. President Obama, of course, a Democrat as president. But this time the Republicans basically sided with the president.
That's the business-oriented party in the U.S., generally associated with Republicans. There are exceptions, of course, but by and large, Democrats opposed this deal, and the reason is that they fear that American jobs will be lost. Democrats in the U.S. are often aligned with unions, and unions are pretty much uniformly against free trade, figuring that American workers are hurt.
Ken Breedemeyer following economics for us in our newsroom. Thanks for joining us today.
Always glad to.
Well, amid the completion of the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal, global markets are up. And to tell us why is Alexis Christophorus, who joins us from the VOA New York Bureau.
U.S. stocks surge toward the longest rally of the year as traders bank on the Federal Reserve to keep interest rates lower for longer following a somewhat weak jobs report for September. That boosted assets from commodities to emerging markets. The Standard & Poor's 500 index extended its rally to more than 5.5% over 5 days. Equities are, of course, recovering from a rout sparked by concern that slowing growth in China will spread to Europe and America. At the same time, the Fed is considering tightening monetary policy for the first time in 9 years. Data today indicated the pace of growth in U.S. services industries cooled last month from the best readings in a decade. Meantime, oil rose above $46 a barrel after data showed a reduction in the number of rigs drilling for crude in the U.S., signaling output cuts in the world's biggest consumer. Jim?
I understand, Alexis, that former Fed Chief Ben Bernanke does not think that the U.S. economy is ready for that 1% rate hike.
That's right. The former Fed chairman says he sees no reason why central bank policymakers should rush to increase interest rates. He said it is not evident that monetary policy is too easy because inflation is so low and full employment is only starting to emerge. Bernanke refused to second-guess current Fed chair Janet Yellen on her decision not to increase rates at the Fed September meeting. He called it a, quote, tough call and said Friday's weak employment report for last month was a negative. The China slowdown, he says, has been broadly anticipated because of Beijing's move to more of a consumer-driven economy. He said the open question is whether the economy there is slowing more than one would expect after such a transition. Bernanke argued investors should not get too worried about the recent problems in Chinese stocks because he said the market there does not relate too much to the economy. Jim?
Our interest is always high when we hear Alexis Christophorus tell us the latest economic news. Alexis, thank you.
You got it. Thanks.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens.
Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
On a leafy campus near Cambodia's capital, Phnom Penh, a group of 50 schoolchildren are benefiting from a bold educational experience and an experiment with dual aim to turn out youngsters who can improve the country and to develop a model program that can be replicated internationally. Robert Carmichael has more from Phnom Penh.
In 2012, staff from the Liger Learning Center interviewed hundreds of children across Cambodia to find the most promising students. Eventually, 25 boys and 25 girls were selected. Each received a scholarship, full board and tuition. 13-year-old Se Ha was one of those chosen. His impoverished parents were thrilled.
They support me a lot because they wish they could go to this school when they was my age. Because when they was my age, it required a lot of money and working to get to school. And this school, we pass a scholarship and it's free.
Most of Liger's 50 students are, like Se Ha, from poor families. In Cambodia, with its weak education system, to be born poor is to have little or no opportunity. The Liger school wants to change that for these 50 students, for another 50 students next year, and in the long term for the country. US businessman Trevor Guile, who co-founded the school with his wife, was in Cambodia last week and told VOA that the aim is to help people help themselves rather than just give away money. That means those who attend the school also pledge to give back.
We have essentially promised to these children, come to us, we'll see you through your high school years. Now, in return, and one of the reasons that we are so focused on making sure they identify with their own culture is that it's going to be a poor investment if we turn out this brilliant young person who's ready to take the world by storm and they leave Cambodia and never look back. That will not be the desired outcome, not by a long shot.
Although education in Cambodia is slowly improving, the well-regarded education minister has been in the job just 2 years and has a mammoth task ahead. Robert Carmichael for VOA News, Phnom Penh.
Well, education plays a big role at the movies. There's no room for phasers or teleporters in Ridley Scott's new film, The Martian. The film is based on Andy Weir's best-selling novel, which is a simple but riveting story about how a man can survive on Mars using just a few tools and some really good math skills. VOA's Penelope Palou has more.
At around 4:30 a.m., our satellites detected a storm approaching the Ares 3 mission site on Mars. The storm had escalated to severe, and we had no choice but to abort the mission. But during the evacuation, astronaut Mark Watney was killed.
Except that Mark Watney is very much alive.
This will come as quite a shock to my crewmates and to NASA and to the entire world. But I'm still alive. Surprise.
So begins the scientific roller coaster ride chronicling his struggle to survive and NASA's attempts to rescue him. Watney, played by Matt Damon, has supplies for only 31 days.
Here's the rub. It's going to be 4 years for another mission to reach me. And I'm in a hat designed to last 31 days. So I got to make water and grow food on a planet where nothing grows. But if I can't figure out a way to make contact with NASA, then none of this matters anyway.
He succeeds in making contact with NASA, but there is no warp speed here. Watney's ride home is a year away, and he needs food and water.
Luckily, I'm a botanist. Let's do the math.
That's one of the joys of The Martian, says filmmaker Ridley Scott. Its commitment to scientific accuracy.
It's as near fact as it could possibly be. So the challenges are reality, not fantasy. There's nothing in there that you can't do. There's nothing in there that he uses that isn't already on Mars.
Like a postmodern Robinson Crusoe, Mark Watney uses his ingenuity and intellect to survive.
I guarantee you that at some point, everything's gonna go south on you. And you're gonna say, this is it, this is how I end. Now you can either accept that, or you can get to work.
Jim Green, director of Planetary Division at NASA, advised the filmmakers about the terrain and look of Mars. He says movies like The Martian inspire us to keep looking to the stars.
In the 2030s, we're going to be visiting Mars. Humans will be flying by Mars in ways. And then in 2040s and 2050s is when the president wants us to get boots down on the ground.
Green, who recently announced that scientists found liquid water on Mars, says, as in Mark Watney's story, space exploration and survival are in our DNA. Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to International Edition, and you can always find us at our website. That, of course, would be voanews.com. We're also on Twitter. You can follow us there as well, at @VOA_IE. We thank our director, Tracy Carter, and wearing her fashionable jacket, our engineer, Zeynep Abdel-Rahman. And thank you for joining us. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Have a super day. Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
When Russia announced it was going to use military force, including air power, in Syria, Moscow claimed it was doing so to fight the terrorist group ISIL. But the first Russian airstrikes in Syria, which began on September 30th, have targeted territory in which few, if any, ISIL forces are operating. Such strikes have raised concern around the world about Russia's priorities in Syria, whether the Kremlin is in fact focused on defeating ISIL or on protecting its longtime ally, Syria's brutal dictator, Bashar al-Assad. In remarks at the United Nations, Secretary of State John Kerry emphasized that the United States and the coalition it is leading will continue its ongoing air operations, which have made significant inroads against ISIL.
The coalition that we have built, more than 60 countries strong, has been taking on ISIL for more than a year by liberating Sinjar Mountain, liberating Kobani, liberating Tikrit, where now more than 100,000 residents have been able to return to their homes and resume their lives, defending Mosul Dam, defending Haditha, protecting Baghdad, rescuing endangered minorities, killing ISIL leaders and facilitators, and taking away the entire northern border of Syria for ISIL east of the Euphrates River.
At the same time, Secretary Kerry noted, the U.S. has mounted a comprehensive campaign to cut terrorist financing, curb recruitment of foreign terrorist fighters, and expose the lies that ISIL is perpetrating. And there is more.
Today, as we speak, south of Kirkuk, Kurdish Peshmerga are heroically liberating villages from ISIL under the cover of coalition airstrikes. In addition, we continue to admire the courage and the resilience that has been demonstrated for four long years of struggle by the legitimate opposition to Assad.
Russia has argued that Assad must be supported in order to defeat ISIL, but Secretary Kerry noted that as ISIL made inroads through large swaths of Syria, Assad didn't try to stop them. Instead, his regime focused all of its military power on moderate opposition groups who were fighting for a voice in Syria. Secretary of State Kerry said that the answer to the Syrian civil war cannot be found in a military alliance with Assad. Rather, it must be found in a broadly supported diplomatic initiative aimed at a negotiated political transition, which would unite all Syrians who reject dictatorship and terrorism and want to build a stable and united society.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.